Today we're going to learn about the Haftorah of this coming week. Usually we learn about the Parsha. This time we learn about the Haftorah. The Haftorah, as we mentioned in the past, is something that was created by the time of the Greeks. The Greeks made a rule that you cannot read, you're not allowed to read from the five books of Moses. Jewish people used to read from the five books of Moses every Shabbat since Moses' time. Moses instituted this tradition to read from the Torah, from the five books, from the Chumash. And the Greeks realized that this is the secret for Jewish survival. And they banned it to read from the five books of Moses, from the Chumash. What the rabbis did, they looked in the prophets for pieces, for stories in the prophets who are similar stories to the stories in the Bible. And they chose to read them instead of the parsha of the week. This is the Haftorah from the book of Kings, that a piece from the prophet, a chapter from the prophet, who is similar to the stories of the parsha of the week. If you don't mind to close this door, because this creates noise, soon you'll see. Then we'll start with, the story is about a prophet, Ovadia. Ovadia was a Edomite. He was a non-Jewish man who became a prophet, a convert who became a prophet. And he was during the time of Isabel and Ahab. These were a king and a queen. The queen was even worse. She was not Jewish or a convert. And she was chasing all the prophets. At that time, there was not only one prophet in a generation. They were called Bnei Nevim, disciples of prophets. There were many prophets. You went to school to become a prophet. You went to school to become a rabbi, you become a prophet. There is no school for prophet today, I can tell you that. But at that time, if you would do the right thing, there were prophecy in the world, on earth. Everybody was able, people were able to get in tune to it. And the prophet, didn't say what he liked. He was an idol worshiper. He was against God. And what's the best solution? To kill them. Ovadia was hiding 100 prophets in two caves, 50 in one cave and 50 in another cave, until the king will die or something will happen and will stop to kill the prophets. Ovadia, because he was a convert, I think he had an easier time with the government. And they didn't chase after him. Therefore, he was the one who saved the Jewish prophets. And because he saved the Jewish prophets, he deserved, God rewarded them with prophecy. That's what really happened. Now, to save the Jewish prophets, he needed to do something. He needed money. He spent all his fortune to support 50 in one cave, another 50 in another cave, probably to bribe a few people in between. When he had no money, he went to the king to borrow money. He didn't tell him what he needs the money for. The king gave him money. And then one day the king died, Mazel Tov. And the same time, Ovadia died. Now, the son of the king, Yehoram, is sending creditors to collect the money from Ovadia's wife. And he tells her, if you don't have the money, we'll take your kids as collateral. Instead of money, as slaves. That's the background of the story. Now we'll get into it a little bit. We'll start to read slowly but surely. Go ahead.
One woman from among the wives of the prophet's disciples cried out to Elisha, saying, "Your servant, my husband, has died, and you know that your servant feared God. But now the creditor has come to take my two sons to be his slaves."
One woman from the wives of the son of the prophet. That means to say, from among the wives of the prophet, here it doesn't say Bnei Nevim, means like loyal level of prophecy. Okay, let's read the commentary. Go ahead.
One woman from among the wives of the prophet's disciples. Our sages explain in the Midrash that she was the wife of Ovadia, and the creditor was Yehoram, the son of Ahab.
The son of Ahab, yeah.
Who had lent Ovadia money with interest. Ovadia had sustained the prophets during Ahab's reign. It is his widow that cried out to Elisha that her husband had died, and he had feared God, and that because he owed it this debt and she didn't have possessions with which to repay, the creditor wanted to take her two sons as slaves.
There is another midrash that says that she went to her husband's grave and she told him, "What have you done to me? You left me now with this Torah." Go ahead.
The chief prophet. Oh, okay.
Yes. And what is happening, she went to her husband and she told him, "Righteous man, what have you done to me? You left me with nothing." She heard a voice in her mind, whatever it was. He told her, "Go to Elisha." The prophets were like holy people, like rabbis, holy people. And when people had trouble, they went to him for help. There are stories with Saul. He was looking for the sheep that he lost. He went to Samuel to ask him, "Maybe you know where we can find them." It was a very normal behavior to go to the prophets when you're at a crisis. He should help you. Then he sent her to Elisha. Elisha was alive. He was the main prophet, the chief prophet of the Jewish people at that time. Okay, cried out to Elisha.
Obadiah and Ahab died at the same time, and King Jehoram came to enslave his two sons. What did she do? She went to the cemetery, crying hysterically. She stood at her husband's grave and cried out, "You who fear God, this is what they are doing to your orphan children."
That's from the Zohar. Continue.
Obadiah was informed, "Your wife is standing at your gravesite, screaming and crying." What did he do? He went to Ezekiel. Perhaps this should read Elijah, but he replied, "I have had enough of that world." He went to the forefathers and said, "This is my situation." And they responded, "We already heard her cries. Go to the prophet Elisha."
It's interesting what the Zohar describes it as a way that people are in Elijah, whatever it was, they were already dead at that time. That this tzaddikim who died, he came to them in heaven, he told them, "My wife," they told him, "I had enough of this world. Go to somebody who's alive." We retired. You don't want to hear about these Dreykops about, I need a cell phone, I need this, I was fighting with this. He went to the forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, told them, "Go to the prophet who is alive." Meanwhile,
she returned to his gravesite, still crying hysterically. He said to her, "Listen, my poor one, go to Elisha, and he will advise you." She immediately went to Elisha.
She went to Elisha. Eventually, it ends up by the door of the great scholar, the great Rebbe, the prophet who is in that generation. He has to deal with it. He will not. Tzaddikim, see, the later the tzaddikim are, the closer are to our time, the more they can relate to human beings' problems. You understand? Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, there was no cars in their time. Then the problems of our generation, they can look at it as saying, "What are you kvetching about? You have such a good life. You're still krechting? Nothing is good enough for you." But a tzaddik who was just not long ago in this world, he can relate more to the struggles of the people in this world. It does mean that if you pray by Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, will not be answered. But quicker, I believe, it's easier for the tzaddik who was closer to our time to relate to the pain and the struggles of people in our life. Now we go back to the story in the prophet with Elisha from the text itself. Go ahead.
Elisha said to her, "What can I do for you? Tell me, what have you done in the house?"
Elisha tells her, "Okay, what can I do for you? Tell me, you have something in your house?" Why is he asked the question? Because a prophet, a tzaddik, to give a blessing, he cannot make you something from nothing. He cannot create, suddenly money will appear on the table. He says, "You have something? I need to start from somewhere. You can make it bigger, stronger. What you need to start is something. That you have something in your house?" Okay, continue.
She said, "Your maidservant has nothing in the house except for a jar of oil."
A jar of oil. The only bit, a little bit is left, and she has oil. What he told her? Continue.
He said, "Go borrow vessels for yourself from the outside, from all your neighbors, empty vessels. Do not be sparing. Then go in and shut the door behind you and behind your sons."
Let's stop right here. Tells her, go to borrow vessels and empty vessels, as many as you can, and shut down the door. Why it's so important to shut down the door?
So they aren't seen?
Why not?
Because they would be persecuted.
No, they wouldn't be persecuted.
Maybe in case of there was a miracle, nobody else should see it.
Why not?
Because everybody would want a miracle of their own.
You getting closer?
No, I like Odia's idea.
They would report to the king.
What do you mean, everybody? Not everybody.
Maybe
not,
it won't
not,
happen. Maybe
not
won't.
Everybody is afraid. He owes money to the king. Why to close the door? Continue to read. We'll get to it.
Okay. So then, pour oil into all these vessels and carry away the full ones. She went from him and shut the door behind her.
It's written again. She shut the door behind her. Obviously, it's important to shut the door behind her. Go ahead.
They brought vessels to her as she poured. And when all the containers were full, she said to his son.
To her son. It's written his son?
It says his, yeah.
No, to her son.
Where's your pencil?
Okay.
Went to her son. Bring me another vessel, he said to her. There is not another vessel. And the oil stopped. She came and told the man of God, and he said, go sell the oil and pay your creditor. And you and your sons will live on.
Then we have here a few issues here. The miracle was she went, she closed the door, she started to pour oil, and it was pouring and pouring and pouring. Another vessel, that was the miracle. And then she asked her son, give me more vessels. She says, there's no more vessels. The moment he said there is no more vessels, it stopped. The miracle stopped. When you say, I can't take it anymore. Oh, no, you can't. It's finished. And then if she went to the, we'll get to it. Then first of all, why she closed the door? You ever heard about the evil eye? Mm-hmm. Right? The evil eye means that other people will see and they will be jealous and will complain to God, why only Mrs. Ovadia gets a miracle and not me? I'm also a good man. Then therefore, for a blessing to be successful, better nobody should know. The Russian way, secrets. Russians keep secret even for themselves. They don't admit to themselves that they know something. It came because of the whole government, the whole system, with communism, with the KGB.
Russian tradition when the baby is born, like until a month old, nobody.
Yeah, a month. Even a year, I mean, a month. I was once by a priest. I was the only one who was invited because I was the rabbi. I felt so lucky. The rabbi in the world was there. Nobody else was there. But the idea is, where we see it, there is a story. We know when the first, when Moses went up, brought down the first tablet, he went there, everybody came there. It was a big to-do. And what he ended up with the first tablet, they both welcomed. The second time when Moshe went up to Mount Sinai, nobody knew. When he went down, he sneaked into the camp, put the two tablets in the ark, and nobody ever saw it. That Rashi says that God told Moses, the first time was too much noise. Better quiet. A little less noise, you'll be the blessing there. You want the blessing. It's not that we keep it. I'll tell you, there is a difference. If somebody asks you, how is business? And they start to complain. That's, if this business are good and you complain, you're actually denying the blessing of God. But it doesn't mean that you have to run around and say how much money you have. Or how your kids are doing. My father always used to say, Baruch Hashem, that's it. It's like this. If your kids are doing well and other people, kids don't do well, do you actually make them feel bad? Well, when you need it? You create jealousy. He told her, close the door. The question is not what he told her, why it's written. If it's written, obviously there is a lesson here. That's the first lesson. The second, okay, let's go to source number 4. I'm jumping ahead of myself.
The prophet asked her, what do you have in your home? This was because it was the custom of the prophets to associate a miracle with physical matter so that it would not constitute a new creation from nothingness.
Ex nihilo. It means to say, we don't create, the prophet doesn't create something from nothing. He needs to start somewhere. And then he gives a blessing. That's why by tzaddikim, they gave you a piece of cake. You ask for a blessing, he gave you something, gave you a dollar. They gave you something to hold on. The blessing should have a beginning, something to, a physical, materialistic thing to hold on. The blessing should be on something. If not, it's kind of evaporating. You need to start somewhere. It says, what do you have? You have something I need. I want to give you a blessing, but you need to have something. So I have oil. It would be oil. She would have to say wine. We give you whatever it was. Vinegar would be. You need to start somewhere. Then he goes to the point of number 5. Continue.
Shut the door. It's honorable for the miracle to arrive.
What is this word?
Secretly.
You don't make noise. You get a miracle, take it and run away. Don't make too much noise. There is one more story, or one, a few more points that I want to make a point. Let's go back to page number 5. He told her, right? And then the oil stopped, right? She went to ask the man of God what to do with it. What's the question? You wanted a miracle. You said you don't have money. He says, go, take empty vessels. She has oil. Sell the oil. You need money, right? Well, she goes to Nujim again. Not in the case. Give you a miracle. Get out. Again. What's the question? What she wanted. He told her, oh, go sell it, and you pay off the debt, and you will leave it with a reminder. Takes a genius to say it, to understand that. What exactly she didn't understand that she need to go to the king, to the prophet again? The prophet made her such a huge miracle. Vos vilzi, nochamol, again and again. What do you want from his life? He has other people waiting for him. But the Medrash says something amazing. Not only it was a miracle that she had oil, the price of the oil went up. Even better, then go and sell it. Now, what do you think? What was the question? What do you think?
Do I have permission to sell it?
The price of the oil went up, then sell it. Even better.
Well, why the price of oil went up?
It was another miracle.
Oh, okay.
The stocks went up. The price of the oil went up.
When it's more on the market of oil,
it should be down.
Yeah.
That's the miracle. Okay. That day, the price of the oil went up. She was able to sell it and pay. She went to ask the prophet. The stocks went up. Should I sell it now? I should wait a little longer. Maybe it'll be even higher. That was the question. Isn't this a Jewish question? Should I wait now?
It's a human question.
We should wait a little longer. I always say that who wins from the stock market? When it's low, your wife tells you, sell the stocks. Are you crazy? It's low. He says, now I will sell it, I will lose money.
It's like the...
When it's high, your wife tells you, now sell it, it's stupid. Who is winning from the stock market? The cardiologist and the psychologist.
Well, the clients say, you bought a stock at 10, it goes to 20, then it went back to 18, you lost $2.
He's in the business. He knows how frustrated they are.
Most people sell when
it's... The question was, maybe I should wait a little longer. The prophet is telling them, don't be a duis, you know. Hashem makes you a miracle. Go and take care of it. Use it. And then you will be go down. You'll complain to me again. Hashem makes you a miracle, a double miracle. You got oil and the price went up. Sell it. He told us, sell it. And from the money that you're going to have, you will live, as the Medrash says, until the resurrection of the dead. Your family, your children, your grandchildren. Because your husband made such a big mitzvah that he saved 100 prophets, your children forever, they will always have money. That was a blessing. Now, always trying to find out if I'm from the descendants of Ovadia. I don't know. I wish. This is the story. Now we're going to take the story to a whole different level. What do I mean with that? Chassidus comes and teaches us. Until now, you read the story from 3,000 years ago. Very nice. It was a man, Yoram. He wanted to take the two kids as a collateral. And it was a woman. He came to cry to the prophet. And she said, a nice story. Beautiful. Fine. Thank you. Beautiful. Oh, that's so nice. What does this say to me? You come home, your spouse asks you what you learned. I learned a story. Chassidus comes and teaches us that every story is about me. Not about angels, not about a story that happened 3,000 years ago. It's a story about me and my life and my relationship with God. Every piece in the Bible is about me with God, my service with God, my service with other people. It's not, we don't read history. We're living with the Bible. It's talking about us. And that's what you're going to learn now. How this is something that talks about us. One of the examples is, you know, the book of Song of Song. Mm-hmm. What's the book of Song of Song about? You ever read it? What's the Song of Song about?
This is the relationship between the Jewish people or you.
What is written in the book? Don't tell me now the commentary.
It's love story.
It's
right?
A love story.
Right.
Yeah. Comes the Talmud and tells us, you cannot learn it in the literal meaning. It's not about a love story. Why you put it in Bible, love stories? What is this, crazy? You know, there was all discussion in the time of the Talmud, and they decided which book should make it to the Bible from the prophets and from the scripture, and which not. If to put the book of Song of Song included in the Bible, to include it in the Bible, then Rabbi Akiva said, if all the books are holy, this is the holy of holies. Why? Because it's a description of the relationship between God and the Jewish people. Then the husband is God, the Jewish people are the wife. Why? Most of the people get all insulted. Why is he not the wife? Why am I not the husband? Because the husband is the giver and the wife is a receiver when it comes to create a baby. God is the giver, we are the receivers. That the whole Jewish people are the wife and God is the husband. And it's a love story. And if you read this story, it's a love story, you understand so many things about our relationship with God that makes everything clear. The same idea is in this text. Let's read source number 6. Avia, please.
There is a well-known rule of the sages. The Torah speaks of of heavenly matters and only hints towards physical matters. In essence, the Torah is actually talking about heavenly matters from a spiritual perspective. Its apparent references to the two materialistic matters are only a hint of their real character.
It's basically the Torah is speaking in a spiritual sense. It's also referring to physical things. But there is an inside story. There is the deeper way, the deeper layer of the Bible, of the whole Torah. And when you look at it from this side, it's a different story. You live a different life. Not only it's a different story, your life is a different life. Okay, the characters.
The woman refers to the soul. She is called here, one woman, because the soul is one with God.
Ve'isha achas, right? The story starts, one woman came to Elisha. Who is the woman? Me and you. The my neshama, that's here. Why it's one? Because the soul is one with God. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Echad, is one with God. We have to be one with God. Then the story is not about the woman of Ovadia's wife. It's about me. Continue.
From among the wives of the prophets, disciples, the Hebrew word for prophets, Nevi'im,
mm-hmm.
stems from the word Nev
Sfataim,
speech of the lips, because they received God's word. Likewise, every soul is created with the ability to receive and perceive godliness.
We are a little bit like prophets. Every neshama, every Jew, is like a little prophet.
Or at least we think like.
Yeah. Yeah, I heard once from a rabbi, he said in Israel, every taxi driver speaks like a prophet. He knows how to save all the problems, everything. He's taking care of all the issues. Then, you know, there is sometimes you wake up in the morning and an idea comes to your mouth, like a verse from the Bible comes to your mouth. It's considered like a little bit of a prophecy. Things like this. And every neshome is really a vessel to God. The more we are connected, the more we are connected to God, then the ideas that come to our mind could be a little bit, don't become a prophet, but it could be good intuition, holy intuition. We are vessels to the spirituality. Who is Elisha? Okay, you want to read? Please. Okay.
Elisha, when the work is broken apart, refers to God
himself. Eli. Eli is God, right? Elisha. God in Shah means from its word to Yesha. It calls also from the word the God of redemption, of bringing miracles, of making miracles, of Yeshua. If you break the word, you can take the Yud on both ways. Basically, but the main thing is Eli. Eli is the name of God. That suddenly it's about my soul, me, calling out to God. It's not about a woman speaking to Elisha. It's me turning to God. What I want from God. Go ahead.
When the verse describes how the woman cried out to Elisha, it is a reference to the soul crying out to God.
The soul is crying out to God. What the soul wants from God.
Me?
Yeah, please.
Your servant, my husband, has died. The Hebrew for my husband is she, is a combination of the word, ash, fire.
Fire. And the letter Yud. Oh, wow. Let's stop right here. Avdecho ishi meis, my husband, your servant, my husband. Husband can have be many words, but in the Bible, many times, husband is ishi. Ishi means ash. Could be husband, could be a fire. Sometimes the husband is a fire. Sometimes, you know, that's the way it goes. Ash, my fire died. The neshama says to God, my fire died. Eish Yud, Yud is the name of God. My fire to, what means my fire died? My love to God died. I used to have love to God. I used to love God. I used to wake up in the morning so excited about God. Now, God, that's what is happening. Continue to read. The soul cries out.
The soul cries out. I harbored a fiery love and intense yearning to be connected and subsumed by godliness. Represented in the letter Yud, but it has died. The love is no longer.
No longer love. I used to have a love to God. Garnished. I used to pray, get excited about prayers. Now I pray, it's like, every word comes out like stones out of my mouth. You know, people come in the morning to put on film 7 o'clock. Some people come excited, enthusiastic. Some people just come like this and put on. I remember many years ago, it was a bar mitzvah boy saying his father made him come for a few months before his bar mitzvah to daven every morning. He said, I joined 10 grumpy men every morning. By his bar mitzvah, he said it. And they really described it very well. 10 grumpy men. That's why b'chassidim, in a normal world, we learn chassidus a little bit, you drink a cup of tea or coffee, and then you daven, you connect to God. But you come like this, you come, but it's dead. It's a dead prayer. It's a dead service. There is no neshome in the mitzvahs that you do. Sometimes people sit by the Seder, and it's only him and his wife, and they look at each other, again the Seder. Again Hanukkah candles. I used to be with the kids. It was so exciting. It was this. Now it's dead. That's what she's complaining. The neshome, I'm complaining. The fire to God is gone. The love to God is not there. Continue, Michael.
But now the creditor has come to take my two sons to be his slaves. The Hebrew word for the creditor, noshe, also means to forget. It refers to the animal soul, which causes the soul to forget about God.
Oh, here comes something worse than that. The creditor is coming to take the two sons for collateral, for slaves. What does this mean? Read this next paragraph. My two sons.
My two sons. Refers to the love and awe of God. As Tanya explains, emotions are called offspring, and the two main emotions are love and awe.
Okay, love and fear. Okay, I have something very interesting to tell you. You know, a kid is not afraid of fire. Why?
Doesn't know.
Because he doesn't understand to be afraid of the fire. You give him a dollar or a candy, what he'll take? He'll take the candy. The dollar is worth more than the candy. He doesn't have enough seichel to understand that the dollar is better, right?
Not in our right time. Candy were more than a dollar.
Yeah. Then what is happening? Love to something is an outcome, is a child of your understanding. Fear of something is a child of your understanding. Where a child is running on the table and is not afraid to fall. Is that because he's brave? He doesn't get it. Then our love and fear is an outcome of our thinking, of our chokhmah and bina. We have the wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. Every person has intellectual faculties and the emotional faculties, attributes. The intellectual faculties, the one given to understand what to love and what to fear, they give birth to the feelings. The feelings are an outcome of our understanding. What we appreciate, but it's good for us. We understand this is good for us. We love it. What we think it's dangerous, we start to be afraid. We are afraid of it. Then understandings in Judaism are three. You know, Chabad stands for wisdom, understanding, and knowledge. They are called the Avot, the fathers, like three fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Every one of them represents a different level of intellectual, so to speak. And then there is the children. The children are the emotions. They are an outcome of our intellectual part. The creditor, the evil inclination, is coming to take the emotions to him as slaves. What does this mean? Love to God is an emotion that comes out from my understanding that I love God. Why I should love God? Because God is doing for me everything. Because God is the ultimate. Because many reasons. And therefore I love God. Now my fire to God is gone. Not only I don't love God, what happens is I start to love other things. I start to be afraid of physical things. If I would be afraid of God, I wouldn't be afraid of anything else. Because I would know that God is the one who protects me. The reason why I'm afraid of everything else is because I don't have fear of God. Then the neshome, the person complains, I lost my fire to God and my animal soul, my evil inclination took over. Now I love money and I'm afraid of COVID and all of the physical things. Then the children, the creditor, the animal soul took the children as slaves. They became... You know, there is no such thing a person say, I don't love God and I don't have anything physical. Every human being has a love and fear. If you don't put in the end, you don't use it for the right things, you use it for the wrong things. You know, people don't believe in God, they become believers in science. They don't have a religion, they adapt a religion. It could be global warming, it could be COVID, it could be whatever it is, a political way of thinking. They adopt a religion. It could be sometimes exercise becomes a religion. People use the word even, I religiously do it. Mm-hmm. I religiously do it because this is his religion. That's why he's religiously doing it. I religiously do my religion, not exercise. I should do exercise, but that's a separate point.
Prager uses this phrase, I forgot who said it, like when people stop believing in God, they don't believe in nothing, they believe in anything.
Exactly, they believe in other things. And like you mentioned, that they made Stalin, they said he's like he's still alive.
Lenin.
In Russia, they created a religion. What do you think? Because people need to, there is a need to believe. The same thing, there is a human being is afraid and loves something. If you don't love God, you love something else. The creditor, the evil inclination, took my love and fear and put it in the other direction. That's what the Neshama is saying. Okay, continue.
And the creditor has come to take the children as slaves to other foreign loves and oaths. In addition to the fact that the animal soul makes me forget about God and wants to, God forbid, nullify my love and awe of him, it also wants to take my love and awe as slaves for his own animalistic
pursuit and passions. Yeah. The animal soul makes me start to love other things. I don't love anymore God. I love everything else besides God. Then the neshama says, we have a problem here. The neshama comes to God and complains. God, what should I do? The Jew stands in shul, says, I would like to have love and go to God, but I don't. What should I do? God, tell me. You have an idea for me? You have a solution? Certainly it's not about Elisha and Novadia's wife and money and prophets. It's about me and God. My problems today in 2021, almost 22, right? No, not yet. Okay. Elisha said to him.
Elisha said to her.
Elisha means God. God said to him. Yeah.
What have you in the house? Which capacities do you retain control over? What has the animal soul not conquered yet?
Is anything left?
That's a question.
Are you so lost? Is anything left? Are you still loving some mitzvahs? You love that you love Pesach? That you love Purim? You love to drink L'chaim on Purim? You do. Is there anything Jewish that still excites you? That's a question. You know what the soul answers? Continue.
She said, your maidservant has nothing, except for jar of water.
The maidservant said, the neshama says, I have nothing. No, I love nothing. Not Purim and not Pesach, not Rosh Hashanah, not Yom Kippur, Gurnish, not fear of God, not love of God. It doesn't speak to me. Nothing. I'm like dead, finished. Nothing excites me. But something is left. What's left?
Yeah.
The only thing
the soul has left is its soul itself. The jar of
oil. Jar of oil. Why is the jar of oil compared to a soul?
Yeah.
To the soul itself. What do you think?
Why we light
from this? Why oil?
It's a vessel.
It's not the vessel. It's the oil.
Oil.
The vessel is the body, by the way. The jar, we are the jar. And we have the soul. The soul, there is something that's called a pinteleid. You ever heard about it? The spark of the Jew. Mm-hmm. There is a Jew in every person that nobody can erase.
You were so talking about, like, you have to find this spark in everyone.
Exactly. In every Jew, there is a spark. No matter how many times he will convert to Christianity, or he will do no matter what, he can scream he's an atheist forever. He still has it. And that's what he count on. Why is it compared to oil? What do you think?
Oil can take a shape. It's a liquid.
The oil is the
on fire.
Is the, what you light. It's this.
Yeah.
From the oil you make fire, but why is this compared to oil? No.
I like the idea of a shape. It takes different shape. Plus,
it can
go
water?
Into fire.
Yeah.
No, but it also can make fire.
Oil is energy, the source of it.
You can spark.
Oil is energy. We have atom. Why we didn't compare it to atom? We didn't have atom in the time of the Bible. Why oil? Why we light candles? Hanukkah, we light oil. It's a miracle of the oil. Why God made a miracle with oil? What's unique about oil? There is many liquids. There is water.
It doesn't mix with water. It doesn't mix with anything else.
First of all, that's when it doesn't mix with anything. That's why with juice, that's a comparison to juice to oil. You don't compete.
Yeah, we're mixing good with anything.
And not only we don't mix with anything, oil always goes to the top.
Because it's less dense.
Because what?
It's less dense.
Well, why
is it less? Last dense didn't give us the answer. Oil comes from where? From Aleph. When you look at the Aleph, you see oil. See nothing. You see olives.
You squeeze it.
You have to squeeze it very hard to get oil. There is sometimes in a Jew, you don't see oil. You see a stubborn, obnoxious. I don't want to say many other words because they're Jews. You have to squeeze it. Now you squeeze out from the Jew the oil. You know how? How you squeeze it out?
I agree.
No. God forbid. By an og. You give him an og. That's the Rebbe's way. Not by Tzores. We don't wait, God forbid, that Tzores should come. We give him
a
og.
It is a given, you know. Yeah, I deserve it. But not
I'll give him an og. I'll squeeze out the oil from him. The love of God will wake up the love. That's why it's compared to oil. He says we have a jar of oil. There is a little bit of oil that nobody can take away. Nobody in the world can take it, can erase it. Oh, that we have something. God says, no, there's something to work with. Something is there. What do you say? You have nothing. You have something. He said, go ahead.
He said, go borrow vessels for yourself from the outside. Do not be sparing. Study the Torah and observe the mitzvah.
Oh, what does this mean? Empty vessels. What means in our spiritual life, empty vessels?
Other people, other Jews that are not spiritual.
We'll get from him. He's giving me help, first of all, to the person. Empty vessels, people say, you know, I came to shul, I put on film, I didn't feel anything. It was an empty vessel, it was nothing. I was doing it. Why should I do it? It doesn't do anything to me. That's the language. It doesn't do anything to me. Mm-hmm. Another no excuse in America. It doesn't do anything to me. Since when it has to do to you something, it has to do to him something. Then Hashem said, it's empty vessels. Hashem said, don't worry. Collect empty vessels. People, when the Rebbe came out with the whole campaign of film, you meet a person on the street, you put him on film, he doesn't even know what happens to him. Some cases, they really don't know what happened. The boys catch him, they force them to put him on the film, they force him to say the blessing, oh, he's running away, he moves on. It's empty vessel. It's empty vessels. You do mitzvahs. I prayed, I came to shul, it didn't mean anything. I was standing there, Yoshi Yom Kippur. I was looking, I was doing nothing. It didn't mean anything. All the prayers doesn't speak to me. It doesn't make sense. I read it all. Don't worry. Collect empty vessels. Yeah, don't worry. It doesn't mean to you anything. Do it. Do it anyway. Do it because of your commitment, because the soul, the connect, because you're connected to God. You have no logical reason why you do it. You don't have an emotional reason. Nothing. When the Jews in Russia were doing mitzvahs, they didn't have any reasons for it. Not intellectual reasons, because they didn't understand why. Not emotional reasons, because they didn't have a good, it didn't give them a good feeling. It was tzores. But they still did it. It came from the commitment, from the soul, from the spark of God that pushes you to do above logical. The connection, you know that the spark, the jar of oil is the connection to God that's above logic. That doesn't make sense. That pulls people, Yom Kippur to shul, they don't even know why. This is the spark of oil, the spark of God. That's what he says. Continue. I'm sorry, it's up to you in the middle. Those
are vessels for receiving the light of God. Even if they seem to be empty vessels at the moment, lacking love and awe of God, nevertheless, do not be sparing.
I don't love God and I do it. I don't fear God because I do it. I just did it to please you. How many times people tell me, I put on film because to make give you another mitzvah. Really, thank you very much. You give me another mitzvah. I need this mitzvah. I need. But if it makes them feel good, let them be, you'll feel good. Whatever the reason is, make mitzvahs. I don't care what the reason, if there is no reason in the world, just do it.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So, there, when it comes to fasting.
Yes.
So.
Perfect example. Go ahead.
So you fast because you're supposed to fast.
Yes.
But I was always under the impression, I thought I had heard that, and in fact I even thought that they say this, to fast without having a connection as to why you're doing it, it's meaningless.
Okay. Yeah, that's very good that you bring it up. That's exactly what you want to diffuse. Yeah. It's not true. Let's say, I don't feel anything, therefore I'm going to eat a good lunch and Yom Kippur day, because I don't feel anything anyway. You fast until you begin to feel. Not to feel, because you don't feel, is not an excuse not to fast. There is commandment, you have to do it. And you hope and you work to put soul in the commandment, to infuse love there and fear and meaning. That's the job. Our job is to do the commandment, and but not to do them like machines, to put in love and fear. And that's the conversation. Exactly this is it. But to say that, because I know what it's written. Oh, the prophet says, if you fear, you fast and you don't change your ways of behavior, your behavior, it's meaningless. But it does mean you should not fast because of that. You understand?
If your
husband or your kids comes and says, I'm sorry, and he's doing tomorrow the same thing, it's meaningless. But the point is you want him to not to do it, not to stop to say, I'm sorry even. You understand what I'm saying?
For sure.
That's what it is. Go ahead.
So I just want to make a quick comment to this, that there's now people are saying mind-body connection. You can, you know, it's in your head, blah, blah, blah. So when it comes to fasting, physiologically, like people are afraid of it. Oh my God, you fasted 44 hours from Kippur. What are you doing? No water. Physiologically, we're okay. Like we're not going to die. And if
not at all.
Diseases, whatever, that's different. But normal person can do it. But the question is, we're so, like food is such a happy medium. It makes us happy. When we don't eat, we're grumpy and all this. So fasting on Yom Kippur is a special connection. You have to build up for it, so to speak. Like when you start, I think it's hard, but as time goes by, people find meaning in it.
Exactly.
Find different meaning. So then your fasting becomes secondary, and it becomes actually kind of, I don't want to say easy, but you don't worry about it as much. And that's the mind-body connection. Your mind makes your body says, fasting is no big deal. I'm doing it for better.
Moment you find meaning in it, it makes it easier, like every other job that you do. If you know you do something for a purpose, to help something, you that gives you meaning. If you do something with no meaning, it drives you crazy.
Right, and I think actually looking at this, even when talking to kids like this, should I do it or not? And I think when you're starting to do some things here and there, a little bit there, then it's not as difficult. And like any mitzvot, as you're talking about, whatever you do in mitzvah, you just do it because you know you need to do it, and that's all. And this is one of the parts. And
this is the beginning.
With time and getting used to it, and maybe with God's help, you're trying to do more mitzvahs, different mitzvahs.
Absolutely. And not only that, but you find meaning in it, you enjoy it, and you infuse the love and fear, love of God. You do it, you enjoy it.
You're trying to actually to do it and getting used to it, you know?
Exactly.
Like people asking, still you're going to Shabbos, you're going to shul and everything. It's like in the beginning, you're just trying to push yourself and trying somehow to find maybe not to go kind of just
mm-hmm,
thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then when you get into your routine, you actually
enjoy it.
To it. Yeah,
that's the goal. Take empty vessels, perfect. You take empty vessels, you do it anyway, and then that comes the next paragraph.
So what happened to the 10 angry men?
They're doing it. If they would continue,
you're making you smile to them, and they're no longer grumping.
They are not so grumpy. In the beginning, they are 7 o'clock. They are grumpy. By the time the service is over, they're already smiling.
True. I have tested that. That's
during
true.
The service, they're getting better and better. They wake up, you know. Exactly.
No, but sometimes I like when I come. You don't drink coffee, so you're there, and it's like fasting, basically. No, it's true.
You're right.
I experienced it many times. When I come, after it, you feel different.
You feel much good, but even during the service, things are getting better. You can see that the grumpiness level is going down.
You wake up slowly. Yeah.
Exactly.
But in this case, you're preaching to the choir, because we're all here. We're all trying to be less grumpy people.
Okay, no.
Right? So
yes, so.
The rest of them are saying, there's nothing there. Gunnish, I don't want to do it.
But you're right. But the note doesn't say that's the job. The job is to
try to do it.
The job is to squeeze out a little bit of oil, to find the spark of God in every Jew. And it's possible. And it just we need to have patience. Now, we don't squeeze it with tzores. We don't squeeze it with even dog that you give. Don't give too much of a strong dog. You might break his back a little bit. And it's patience and love that will do it. Again and again and little by little. And the main thing is by example. And the people around you see that it gives you meaning, makes you happier, makes you a better person. Then this makes people around you to want to do the same.
Steve, you're absolutely right. People saying exactly what you said, kind of just to come into shul and everything. But you're kind of just saying, hey, I was in your shoes. I was kind of just going through all the stages. And if you trust me, you will just try it a little bit, and then you will start to enjoy it. You will start kind of just...
Yeah, you, God forbid, might start to enjoy it. Can you imagine?
And when that person is ready to do that, they'll do that. But they
doesn't mean
that
you have to stop
says.
To tell him
they need this.
Kind of just
they need this gentle love to be...
Yeah, they need a gentle love. Don't get too enthusiastic, imagine. I might want it. But yeah, a little bit is good, yeah.
I'm listening to a book now, and it explains how, mind by connection works,
mm-hmm.
and usually they say any routine takes about 18 months to become actually, enjoy.
Very interesting, very interesting. 18 months take
18
months.
Yeah.
What's the name of the book?
I forgot. It's by some, it's by founder of some investment group or whatever, but
he speaks about routine.
Yeah, I'll bring it.
I would like.
He's interested in
good.
His sons was bipolar or something.
Yeah,
so he started
to work on him,
learning about how
routine
how mind works. And stuff.
Very interesting. Yeah, because that's the truth, and that's exactly what the discussion is here. You do empty vessels, and here comes the point. Go ahead. Pour oil into all these vessels.
Pour oil into all these vessels. Channel that essence of the soul, the oil, into all your actions. Tanya explains that the fulfillment of Torah and mitzvot is really dependent on the constant memory that we should sacrifice our lives for God. Self-sacrifice comes from the essence of the soul.
Basically, do it because you have to do it. And then?
When that will be the case, you and your sons will live on the remainder. That essence of the soul will sustain you far better than before.
If you will wake up your soul, you start to do mitzvahs, you'll have such an awakening, will give you such joy, then eventually will give you enthusiasm, not only for your mitzvahs, but for the mitzvahs of other people, to inspire other people too. And as we see, many people started with, it's boring, it's this, and they started to do it, and one mitzvah led to the other, and eventually they became an inspiration not only for themselves, for the families, for the children. They find joy in it, in every mitzvah that they do. And as you said, your perfect example, the beginning, going to shul, took you 18 months. Then as you and then you look forward. I over there, so many people used to walk on Shabbat. They said, don't walk on Shabbat. They stopped walking on Shabbat. The beginning was very hard. They felt, oh, it's a... And then they said, everybody who comes to shul, well, we see him, tells me, I look forward for Shabbos. It's the day of rest, the day I'm getting relaxed, the day I forget about all my little troubles. You disconnect yourself from the Mishnah, guys. You look forward for Shabbos. But it takes time. The beginning is hard. And that's the conversation. That's how the story about the Haftorah, about Elisha with oil, is a story about me and God and every one of us. We come to God, his soul comes to God and says, God, I have nothing. I have no love. I have no fear. I don't want to do anything. It's boring. Yeah? But then, that God says, do it anyway, and you'll see things will turn around.
You see explanation, example, it's all good. But another tool,
just do it behind closed door. No, mitzvahs don't do behind closed door. Oh, very important. Don't do it behind closed doors. You want miracles, keep it in your house. But any mitzvah that you do, do it publicly. You know why? Because then other people will learn from you. People tell me many times they want to give a donation anonymously. I told them, your sins you should do anonymously. Your mitzvahs, do it publicly, because when you do publicly, other people will be inspired too. That you get the reward for other people. That's a part of your inspiration. Will give life to other people. What means? Until the resurrection of the dead, as the Midrash says. It means to say every person who doesn't have connection to God is kind of a living dead. When you get a connection to God, you get resurrected, you get excited about your Judaism. That gives you life. That's what it's all about.
Does that actually... That seems contradictory to the levels of... Or maybe I'm confusing them. The levels of helping. That's what I'm looking for. You help somebody where they both know who the receiver is and who the donor is. And then you have...
Oh, you're talking about charity. No. There is charity to individual in need.
Okay.
And in this case, you don't want the individual to know where you got it from because you don't want to embarrass him.
Right.
Then there is charity that you give to organizations. Today, most of the charities that people give are to organizations. They don't give to individuals. You don't have a poor man that you give him money, you throw him in the back, under the door, you slip in cash with an envelope. It doesn't happen. You understand? Then this charity that you do, or volunteering, or mitzvahs that you do, even more, mitzvahs than more than everything. You go to shul, you go to a class, make sure other people know, make sure your kids know about it. When they know, they will be influenced. It will influence other people. That's what I mean. You're talking about private charity to a specific person that you don't want to make sure he's not being embarrassed that he knows that you're helping him.
Right.
That's a different story. Thank you very much, my friend.
Sure.